and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. With a federal judge just blocking the distribution of downloadable 3D printed guns, we'll begin with Joshua Horowitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He joins us to discuss the alarming release of blueprints to manufacture 3D plastic guns over the internet by Cody Wilson, a self-described anarchist and gun rights fanatic who had sued the State Department for restraining him from making these homemade undetectable guns available to anyone and everyone. We will look into how someone in the Justice Department not only dropped the case, but awarded Wilson $40,000 in court costs, and whether Jeff Sessions or Mike Pompeo knew anything about this, because President Trump surely did not, since today, in a confusing tweet, Trump questioned whether these blueprints should have been made available to the public. Then we will speak with Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. He joins us to discuss leaked intelligence from spy satellites indicating the North Koreans are building new intercontinental ballistic missiles, in spite of Trump's claim that after the recent summit with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, North Korea was, quote, no longer a nuclear threat. With Secretary of State Pompeo admitting in recent testimony that the North Koreans were upgrading their nuclear enrichment site and stepping up production of fissile material, we'll assess what the promise of denuclearizing the Korean Peninsula amounts to. Then finally, we'll examine Trump's tweet today dismissing the billionaire conservative donors, the Koch brothers, as a total joke following the Koch network's conclave over the weekend at which Charles Koch blasted Trump's trade agenda, and the network's co-chair issued a statement critical of Trump saying, quote, the divisiveness of this White House is causing long-term damage. Alex Koch, an investigative journalist focusing on money and politics, joins us to discuss speculation that the Koch brothers are reconsidering their almost exclusive support for Republican candidates during this midterm campaign after having alarmed Republicans earlier this year when they funded a digital ad campaign congratulating North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp for rolling back bank regulations. Now that Trump has dissed the brothers, calling their network highly overrated, claiming he is a puppet to no one, and that the Kochs are, quote, two nice guys with bad ideas, we'll get an assessment of how much this is a signal for other Republicans to break ranks with Trump and whether fear of angering Trump's base could be abating. And joining us now is Joshua Horowitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horowitz.
Thanks so much for having me, Dean. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Josh. And what do you make of this extraordinary tweet today from President Trump? On the day before the blueprints of these 3D printed guns are going to be available online, and already, in fact, they're making them available online, because of a decision made by the Trump administration, the president today questioned whether these plastic guns should be made available in this confusing tweet in which he said, I'm looking into 3D plastic guns being sold to the public, already spoke to NRA, doesn't seem to make much sense. So can you make sense of it?
Well, I mean, again, the Trump administration having no idea, or the president having no idea what his own administration is already doing. The administration... the administration in this regard has already said it's okay. And now at the last moment, he sort of figures it out, maybe, and realizes it could be a gigantic embarrassment for him and decides maybe he'll do something. But the day is tomorrow. And it's just another example of poor planning, poor research, parts of the Trump administration going rogue on him, but probably not even informing him. And, you know, it just shows a leader completely out of touch on very important issues to the country.
So can you give us a little bit of a history of this? Because it goes back to the Obama administration, State Department, that stopped this availability of these blueprints online for people to make guns on 3D printers at home. it was initially stopped by the State Department on the basis of these were dangerous in terms of the international firearms traffic. So can you walk us through where we, from
there? Yeah, right. So the State Department came out and prevented these because of through the protections of the Arms Export Control Act, where they can limit what arm goes to other countries. And because these blueprints would be available on the Internet, the State Department had jurisdiction to stop these from being put on the Internet, downloaded by people in this country and all over the world. But I think it's important to define our terms and what we're talking about with these weapons. Now, in terms of printing a whole gun, the gun that is available, you know, currently through this is a single-shot plastic firearm that oftentimes will blow up on that single shot. There's also available you can make with these 3D printers parts. So you can produce parts, for instance, and affix them to a gun like an AR-15 that creates a very important part like called the receiver, and in effect allows you to make one of these AR-15 assault weapons without a serial number. So right now the technology is scary, but it's still relatively basic. The problem we think is when we start thinking about down the road, if this technology gets out there beyond what we have today, it could be people almost every day could be printing weapons. Now, what I'm most concerned about is people downloading the single shot pistol and using it like an assassination tool because it's not detectable by metal detectors. So today you might be able to hear in the background, I'm at LAX. Are the 3D gun that they're putting together wouldn't be detectable at the metal detector I just walked in. And and just likewise for government buildings. So that's to me, the present scary part of this. And that's what the State Department was trying to prevent until the Trump administration basically capitulated to a lawsuit, even paid damages to the plaintiffs who are seeking to make these guns. That's how we got in this present situation.
Well, the owner of this company that's releasing this stuff online, Defense Distributor, the founder, Cody Wilson, is a self-described anarchist. He sued the State Department over its 2013 order demanding that he take down blueprints for what he calls the Liberator, which is a single-shot 380 caliber handgun made out of 3D printed plastic. So I've seen him on television, and of course he's already leaked the stuff online already before tomorrow's date when he's going to be able to do it legally, I guess. But he's basically at war with gun control. He's made no bones about it. Go ahead.
Right. The technology right now is concerning, but the intent of where he wants to go is alarming. His idea is to continue to evolve the technology so you have functioning, working, semi-automatic, 3D printable pistols and assault weapons, and make those weapons in a way that anybody could do it in their living room, thereby circumventing the serialization requirement that we have today and the requirement that guns originally be sold to a licensed dealer so that they can be traced. So what you'd have is unserialized, untraceable plastic firearms. And if you think of the way this technology could develop, if it continues developing in 5 to 10 years, any person who's, intent on mayhem, anybody who's intent on criminality, could easily print these firearms in their own home in a way that we just can't stop. And that's really what he's after. He calls himself, I think, a crypto anarchist, and he wants to disrupt the way that we regulate weapons right now. And if anybody is involved and knows about the way we regulate weapons, we need to regulate weapons far more than we do today to save lives. Regulating them less, making them unregulable, that's really a giant problem and a recipe for more lives lost every year in the United States.
And Joshua Horowitz, do we know who in the State Department decided to settle this case and then turned around and gave this character, Cody Wilson, nearly $40,000 in legal fee to reimburse Defense Distributed. So that's the part that's murky. If Trump didn't know about it, did Pompeo know about it? Who is the official that signed off on this?
I don't really know. You know, I'm at somebody, some low-level person in the State Department that I'm not clear about. So it's all very, very opaque and concerning to me. But it is certainly, you know, unclear. Now, of course, the president is, you know, is trying to backtrack on it.
Well, but it looks as though, Josh, that last month the case was won by this anarchist with a Justice Department ruling that Americans may have access, discuss, use, and reproduce the technical data that he's putting online tomorrow. And on Monday, 21 states' attorney general sent a letter to the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, asking them to withdraw from the court settlement. So that seems to be how we got to this situation. We don't know who in the Justice Department signed off on this extraordinary move, which has even got the president himself apparently alarmed. So sounds like the barn door is open and the horse is way down the paddock.
Well, so first of all, I think I'll take a little bit issue with the guy when you said the case was won. It was not won. It was settled, which meant someone in the Justice Department thought this was, you know, thought this was a good idea, that they should go forward with this and remove the stay that was in place through the Obama administration. So we did. So that's how we got in the situation. And it seems to me that either one of two things: Trump was completely oblivious to what's going on in his Justice Department, or he felt realized down the road with all the stink that he was making a giant mistake. But now you're right. I mean, this has already been. This has already been, you know, some of these plans have already got out there. There's, you know, it looks like they might go into effect tomorrow. So, yeah, the horse is someone out of the barn. But as I mentioned before, what's out of the barn today is a single shot, this Liberator pistol. Yeah, it's dangerous. We don't want it. But what's really scary is the technology that's yet to come. And we need to figure out a solution of this quickly. We do not have any time to waste. This is a clarion wake-up call that this administration needs to do something immediately, or we're going to have not just single-shot pistols out there, but functional semi-automatic, you know, handguns that will evade metal detectors. That will be possible for people, you know, intent on criminality to download in their living room.
Well, it's not just the one gun, though, that he's going to make available online on Wednesday. There are blueprints for 9 types of guns, which were uploaded to the Defense Distributed website on Friday. So they're ready to pull the trigger on that.
Right. The technology is not there for all of these things. And depending on what kind of printer you have, some of them might not be available. There's also parts that are available so that you can take a plastic part and unserialize the sort of the guts of the firearm, add a metal barrel, and have a firearm that's not detectable and unserialized. So it's a really scary proposition, as I mentioned. I mean, the thing is that the most personalized 3D printers, in people's homes are not quite up to the task of all these guns yet, but they will be soon. And that's what I think is the scary part of it. I don't know if you've ever sort of followed the way these 3D printers are made right now, but they're made layer upon layer of plastic, and they are not sturdy enough to withstand considerable use right now, more than 1 or 2 shots. But they will be, right? And so these designs become more scary every day as the printing process and the materials available for printing become more widely available and more advanced.
So, Josh Horwitz, what do you know about this so-called Second Amendment Foundation that, along with Defense Distributed, joined forces in these suits, which, as you say, they didn't necessarily win it, but the government basically gave them a free pass?
Well, so the Second Amendment Foundation is on the spectrum of gun rights organizations, is to the right of the National Rifle Association. They're the people who are even more radical than the NRA. So that tells you where they are on the spectrum. They are for, I mean, this is clearly an attempt to circumvent federal gun laws, and that doesn't surprise me because the Second Amendment Foundation is the kind of, you know, group that is trying to get rid of concealed carry requirement, permitting requirements, and have, you know, no requirements for concealed carry, open carry, would like to get rid of the background check system. So this is a group that really wants, has a guns everywhere, a guns for all mentality, and works on, you know, that's their approach. And so it doesn't surprise me. And it comes from an approach that I think is really misguided, which is the more guns we have in America, the better. The more guns we have that are unregulated, the better. All of the data that we know about, all of the data that we work with shows that more guns in more places will make this country more dangerous. And the fact that they can get beyond the paltry regulatory restraints that we have means there'll be more deaths every year in America.
And are they, the Second Amendment Foundation, are they pushing this reciprocity idea that concealed carry states that, in, you know, in the South, for example, that allow concealed carry, people from those states with permissive gun laws could show up in New York City or in Los Angeles with their concealed carried weapon and have reciprocity, be able to literally break the law in this state?
Oh, absolutely. So that's really, to me, now, so the concealed carry reciprocity is something that keeps me up every night. And so what that means is that in states that have loose or no, when I say no, I mean no, absolutely none requirements on who can carry a concealed weapon. You carry a concealed weapon without a permit, without a background check. The idea of nationwide concealed carry reciprocity is that you can bring the weapon from the state where you live into any other state. So an example would be if you live in Arizona and you can carry a concealed weapon with no permitting, no background check, you can walk into, you know, any, you can go into L.A. or San Francisco or any place in California carrying your weapon when you have not had a background check in violation of all of California's possession laws. So let's just take an example, which is that it is not, you can carry a gun in Arizona if you've been convicted of violent misdemeanor. In California, if you've been convicted of the same crime, you cannot have a gun. You are in violation of California law. But you would then be able to use your reciprocity rights from Arizona to carry in California in violation of California law. And if you've seen the statistics from California, the change in California's gun laws has led to a dramatic reduction in gun violence and gun death in California. Arizona, quite the opposite. But this law, this reciprocity law, would allow the carrying of weapons across state lines under Arizona's laws, not California's.
And is this a Second Amendment Foundation behind this, or is this, or the NRA, I think, are behind this, aren't they?
Well, they're all behind it. They're right. All behind it. But the Second Amendment Foundation, as I mentioned, is even more radical than the NRA. If that's, you know, it's hard to believe, but there are groups out there. The Second Amendment Foundation is one. Gun Owners of America is another. And their whole point is to be to the right of the NRA, which is, if you've been following the National Rifle Association lately, is sort of scary. But the bottom line is, yes, they're pushing this. And, you know, it's very interesting. You know, gun manufacturers can't be too happy with the idea that people will be able to manufacture guns in their living room because, I mean, obviously manufacturers are there to sell their product. But if people can start, you know, start downloading firearms and printing them, downloading plans and printing them in their living room, in their basement or whatever, that can't be good for U.S. firearms manufacturers. So, it's a, you know, the whole thing, it doesn't make a lot of sense. But the Gun Owners of America, very radical, guns everywhere agenda, and that's, you're just seeing, that's why they're pushing this. It's just a furtherance of their agenda to get unregulated guns everywhere in American society.
So when the president tweets out that he's been in touch with the NRA, as far as I know, they get a lot of their money, if not most of their money, from the guns and ammunition manufacturers. So if 3D guns printed at home are going to crimp their business, then perhaps they have some reason to cooperate with Trump, even though, as we mentioned. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that
Yeah, I think the NRA, you'll have to talk to them, but my guess is they're sort of on a vice, in a vice on, yes. They get a lot of money from manufacturers, and manufacturers, you know, definitely don't like this idea. At the same time, their membership base, which they've radicalized, the NRA has gone far right in the last couple of years, wants these kinds of things. So I think their silence is a reflection that their membership, you know, is a lot more radical than it used to be. Not everybody. There's plenty of people in the NRA who are just there for hunting. But there's a lot of people now who are much more into what I would call the insurrectionary Second Amendment and having guns, free of government regulation. And the manufacturers who want to sell a lot of guns but have to play by the rules of traditional distribution, which includes, you know, which includes selling serialized guns and paying taxes and things like that. So, yeah, they're in a tough spot, and it'll be very interesting to see how they come out on this.
Well, Joshua Horowitz, I thank you very much for joining us. This is an alarming move, and as I say, they've already downloading this stuff online or putting it up online, and it's already being downloaded, and tomorrow the floodgates open. So, again, one wonders whether there'll be any action from this government that doesn't seem to know, you know, the right hand doesn't seem to know what the left hand is doing. Or in this case, the right hand doesn't know what the far right hand is doing.
That's a good way to put it. And you're right. There's confusion now. And, you know, hopefully they know how to, you know, hopefully they can get their act together. This is a very fast developing story. But yeah, tomorrow could be the beginning of a new age in U.S. firearms history. And it's an unfortunate part. And you're right. I mean, once one or two gets down there, you know, one enterprising person can start emailing them out, right? So it's a new age we're dealing with. Technology can do lots of great things, but it can also create easy ways to get around the regulatory system that tries to keep us safe in this country.
Well, thank you for joining us here today, Joshua Horowitz.
Oh, no problem. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Horowitz, who's Executive Director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence and the Educational Fund to Stop Gun Violence. He has spent more than two decades working on gun violence prevention issues and is the author of Guns, Democracy, and Insurrectionist Idea. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into leaked intelligence from spy satellites indicating the North Koreans are building new intercontinental ballistic missiles. I know my destiny. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military Adam, like who gets there firstest with the mostest Adams. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They got to get together or disintegrate. I hold this truth to be self-evident, that all men may be cremated equal.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Fuchs, a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff and co-authored The Survival and Success of Liberty, a Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Fuchs.
It's great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Michael. And we learned today that unnamed U.S. intelligence officials told the Washington Post that spy satellites had spotted continuing activity at the North Korean site that produces ballistic missiles. And this has led a lot of people to question what went on in this somewhat vague meeting that took place, the summit with President Trump and Kim Jong-un in Singapore, where the communique that came out of it was very nonspecific, and the only thing that they agreed on is a vague idea of the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. But this latest finding from the spy satellites would indicate that maybe that that agreement wasn't worth the one sheet of paper that it was written on.
Well, look, I think that's exactly right. And to be honest, I don't think this should come as much of a surprise to anybody that North Korea continues to work on its missile programs. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, when testifying before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee last week, also admitted publicly that North Korea still continues to produce fissile material, which is, of course, required to continue to make more nuclear weapons. And so I think that it is very clear to us that North Korea did not commit to anything specific with regard to its nuclear program during the Singapore summit with President Trump, and continues to produce more and more of the dangerous weapons and capabilities that it has that can threaten the United States and our allies. So I think what we're seeing here is, unfortunately, President Trump, for the last number of weeks, going around touting as major successes some of the more superficial acts that North Koreans have taken, such as dismantling a test site for rocket engines. But of course, obscuring the fact that North Korea continues to increase its nuclear arsenal and its missile arsenal.
Well, in the testimony that you mentioned, given by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he was responding to reports that showed that North Korea was upgrading its nuclear enrichment site and was stepping up the enrichment at other sites, secret sites. And this is essentially what we're talking about is bomb fuel for nuclear weapons. And the best that he could say, he admitted that North Korea was continuing to produce nuclear fissile material, but he insisted that progress is happening. That's, again, pretty vague. Any more specifics than that?
Yeah, you know, I think this is obviously a very complicated set of issues. And as everything goes with North Korea, there's only so much that we in the public realm can know of what's going on. And so I think we have to judge based on what we can see. What we know, of course, is that North Korea has stopped for the moment testing its nuclear weapons and its missiles. That is a good thing. We know that North Korea has begun to take, again, what look like superficial, potentially temporary steps that look good, frankly, in the public, such as, again, dismantling this site where it tests its rocket engines. Also earlier, blowing up a site where they test nuclear weapons. And then, of course, the return of 55 remains of POW MIA U.S. soldiers from the Korean War, all of which are potentially good signals. With regard to the test sites, though, there were no international inspectors there to watch the destruction of these test sites. And of course, even if they were genuinely destroyed, they are very easy to, frankly, rebuild. And so I think what we see so far, combine all that with what we now know, that North Korea continues to produce more missiles. It continues to produce more fissile material to make more bombs. North Korea, frankly, is providing enough of what looks like positive momentum publicly while continuing to keep and actually increase its nuclear and missile arsenals. And so it's possible that there's something in the negotiations that's happening that could eventually lead to more progress. But as far as what we know publicly, North Korea right now is sort of doing everything it can to look like it's sending positive signals, but it has not yet touched nor done anything to change its behavior on the core problems of the nuclear missile programs.
So what the leak to the Washington Post basically says is that this facility, Sanam-dong facility outside of Pyongyang, the capital, it appears that the North Koreans are building one or two new liquid-fueled intercontinental ballistic missiles, basic 1960s technology. The missiles that we were worried about that could reach the United States, the Hwasong-15, that is a solid-fueled with the liquid-fueled rocket that takes them a while to fill up the missile with liquid fuel, the right amount for the flight and trajectory. And they're very vulnerable when they're sitting on the launch pad like that. So what do we know about? Why would they be sort of going back in time, if you will, in terms of technology? What would be the advantages of these new ICBMs that are liquid fueled?
Well, look, I think that the important thing here to note is that North Korea has a wide variety of different capabilities when it comes to its the threat that it poses the United States and our allies. Of course, the ICBM and the more advanced stage ICBMs, like the Hwasong-15 that it tested last year, are sort of the most advanced stage weapons that it has. But, you know, like the United States military and like most militaries, you don't stop testing old technology just as soon as you gain new technology. There are a variety of different range missiles that North Korea has that can reach South Korea, can reach Japan, that can reach elsewhere in the region, in addition to its ICBMs. It, of course, has its tremendous amount of artillery that is positioned, much of it directed at Seoul. So, again, North Koreans have obviously a wide variety of different kinds of threats that they pose and different kinds of missiles. It's hard to know exactly what kind of thinking the North Koreans have when, you know, developing something like this. It's entirely possible, again, it's just sort of routine development of more missiles. Maybe some of the others were getting old. But it's also entirely possible that these are the sorts of signals that the North Koreans are sending. They are very strategic oftentimes about what kinds of signals they are sending. They know that satellites, frankly, are watching or trying to watch a lot of what they do. And it's really possible that they are trying to continue to send the signals that, frankly, I think a lot of people have been talking about for a long time, which indicate that North Korea is not willing to give up its nuclear weapons anytime in the foreseeable future. They want, and I think they very much see this diplomacy with the United States and the summit meeting with Donald Trump more as recognition of North Korea as a nuclear power, not as a path towards denuclearization. And if you look at all the other things that they're doing, again, the destruction of the test sites, improvement of diplomatic ties, reduction of tensions with South Korea, all of those things, when you combine them with the fact that they're not doing anything with their nuclear weapons or their missiles, in fact, they're increasing their arsenal, would lead me to believe that that's true, that North Korea sees this process as confirmation of itself as a nuclear power, and it's happy to improve ties while it is a nuclear power.
But doesn't this get to the heart of the problem, though, which is the way that Donald Trump conducts foreign policy and diplomacy, although that may be too generous a description? The idea that he believes that simply by the force of his personality, sitting in the room with a world leader, he can make deals, the art of the deal, etc. This is not how diplomacy operates. All of the work is done before you have these summit meetings, and you just go there to sign the deals. So he goes there with nothing and then signs these meaningless deals. Then Pompeo's doing all the work now, and we don't know the extent to which any of it reflects whatever these sort of lofty promises were. And then you look at what happened in Helsinki. The meeting was totally in private, no note takers, just the one translator. So we have no idea what happened there. Certainly the press conference that followed alarmed a lot of people because of the President Trump's submissive posture towards Vladimir Putin. The one thing that Trump did say that came out of that secret meeting that they held was that Putin had made this incredible offer. Well, the incredible offer turned out to be handing over the former U.S. ambassador to Russia, along with Bill Browder, the guy that Putin wants to kill. I mean, my God, what's going on here? I don't think we've ever seen this amateurism. And by the way, he just made the same offer to the Iranians. You know, let's just sit down and talk and get together in a room without any prep. And, of course, the Iranians told him, go to hell. So is this the problem? The essential problem is that this president we have now thinks he can just do everything by simply meeting with world leaders in private.
Yes, in a single word, absolutely. I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, there are sort of endless problems in foreign policy when the president of the United States believes that all he needs to do is sit down with somebody and he can solve one-on-one all of our problems. Of course, the relationship with Russia and Putin is itself quite a thriller, fiction-type, you know, story with the collusion and the potential out there, and Russia obviously wanting to Trump to win and helping him, frankly, do so in the 2016 election. But fundamentally, you're right. The president is turning what is usually a asset of U.S. foreign policy, namely diplomacy and engagement, and turning it on its head into, frankly, a vulnerability. And you saw that, and you see that right now, I think, with the North Korea engagement. Look, I and many others have been advocating for a long time for the United States to engage directly with North Korean diplomacy. And, you know, even though I didn't disagree, even though I disagreed with the way President Trump did this and calling a summit immediately, I'm happy that he decided to engage with North Korea. But as you pointed out, the way he does the engagement, he removes all U.S. leverage from the process for his own negotiators. He pulled the rug right out from underneath them. So he agrees to a summit meeting instantaneously. And, of course, all the North Koreans need to do in anticipation of that summit is just burn out the clock with the U.S. negotiators, because they know the summit's going to happen. They know they don't need to agree to anything to make the summit happen. And so that's exactly why you see nothing coming out of the summit. And that's exactly why you see very little of substance coming out of the follow-on diplomacy in the last month and a half. It's because Donald Trump continues to tweet out how much progress we're making with the North Koreans, and the North Korean negotiators see this. They know they don't need to be giving it very much to the U.S., in order for the president to actually see this as a positive process. And so, again, Mike Pompeo and the U.S. negotiators are left holding the bag at the table.
Well, I don't know whether you watched Pompeo's testimony the other day before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but it was pretty embarrassing, frankly, that he simply tried to refuse to answer what was obvious, that there was something wrong with the idea that Trump had a meeting with Putin without any note takers, and Pompeo himself was not in that meeting, and yet he couldn't really say what happened in that meeting. And rather than give specifics, he kept saying, well, this is our policy, but without naming what was discussed. And you have a policy, right, at the State Department, as much as it's visible, but you have all these secret negotiations about which nothing has been learned except from the Russians.
I think, again, that's exactly right. You find Trump's advisors, his cabinet, like Secretary Pompeo, really sort of going back and forth between these wildly different explanations for things where, on the one hand, you know, he tries to explain away some of the things that President Trump talks about, for instance, like, you know, taking Putin's word over that of the U.S. intelligence community about the interference in the 2016 election. And then also at the same time, trying to make the case that the United States actually has an incredibly tough policy on Russia by pointing to all of these other supposed things that the United States is doing, again, while completely ignoring the fact that the president of the United States, just as you pointed out, you characterized it, stood sort of submissively up there next to Vladimir Putin, taking his word over that of his own government. And so, again, you find all the rest of the U.S. government officials here basically in an impossible position where their leader is off doing things, many of which they may not be aware of, and they are stuck with nothing more than just reading off talking points. And I actually found one of the things most amazing about Mike Pompeo's testimony last week was that on the one hand, he would repeatedly try to defend President Trump and what he was doing, that he was not giving away U.S. interests and so forth to Putin or to Kim Jong-un or others. All at the same time, Mike Pompeo actually at one point said basically that people should not pay attention to what President Trump says, that the United States has a series of policies on Russia or North Korea, and that we should pay attention to those policies. That's a remarkable statement for a U.S. Secretary of State to make.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, you mentioned, Michael Fuchs, the fact that the U.S. has lost its leverage by the way that Trump conducted this meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore without any preconditions. And the leverage that actually existed to get North Korea to the table I think, was largely the fact that the Chinese went along with UN sanctions, and that was really hurting. And the Russians also, to a lesser degree, were cooperating. Well, now it's my understanding that the Chinese are no longer, because of the illusion of a deal between North Korea and the United States, they no longer have an incentive to restrict particularly the desperately needed fuel that North Korea needs and the Russians provide. And they're smuggling stuff in now, the Russians, and the Chinese are, I think, pretty much given up on the sanctions. And frankly, I can't see why the Chinese would want to cooperate with Trump, because Trump's declared a trade war on them in the first place. So this is, to me, the most reckless and amateurish example of foreign policy imaginable. And really, Kim Jong-un has just got to be absolutely thrilled that he's got so much and given up so little.
I think that that's right. I think that the biggest winners out of the Singapore summit, unfortunately, were Kim Jong-un and Xi Jinping. And I think that, again, if you had a normal administration in place in the United States, you could see a way to actually making some lemonade out of these lemons right now, if you will, with North Korea. But again, we don't have that. We have President Trump. And so I think what's happening right now is that, you know, Kim Jong-un is sort of feeding Trump little by little, just enough to keep Trump happy in terms of these, you know, photos that he's able to continually put out about the return of U.S. POW remains and the destruction of these test sites. And all the while, the pressure comes off of North Korea, and relations between North and South improve, between North Korea and China improve, and the rest of the world is ready to engage North Korea again. And so Kim Jong-un looks the winner, and Xi Jinping at the same time also has the pressure off him when it comes to North Korea again. As you pointed out, Trump has sort of moved on to something else with China and the trade war. And so North Korea is sort of forgotten. And all the things that we're forgetting here is that the maximum pressure campaign, which took years, frankly, to build, predating the Trump administration on North Korea, is gone. It's dead now. And even if diplomacy yields nothing and we need to ramp up the economic pressure again, that is highly unlikely to happen anytime soon.
Well, Michael Fuchs, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, my pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Fuchs. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs and was Special Advisor to the Secretary of State for Strategic Dialogues. He also served as a member of the Secretary of State's Policy Planning Staff and co-authored The Survival and the Success of Liberty, A Democracy Agenda for U.S. Foreign Policy with Morton Halperin. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Trump has been dissing the Koch brothers as a total joke, saying they're two nice guys with bad ideas. Money. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Alex Koch, a freelance writer and investigative journalist focusing on money and politics, whose work has appeared in The Nation, Vice, The International Business Times, and a new startup, Sludge. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Koch.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be back.
And Alex, what did you make of Trump's tweets today attacking the Koch brothers and their network, saying their network is highly overrated, and calling them a total joke, saying that I have beaten them at every turn, and Trump said, I'm a puppet for no one, and that they're two nice guys with bad ideas. And he finishes up by saying, make America great again. What do you think prompted this broadside against these powerful conservative Republican donors?
Well, those donors, the Koch brothers and their growing and pretty powerful political donor network, had their semi-annual donor summit last weekend. It's typically at these high-end resorts. The network has I believe, expanded to around 700 members. And to be a member, you or your foundation has to give at least $100,000 to the network every year. So we're talking about 700 incredibly rich people, mostly old white rich people. And so at the summit, Charles Koch told the members of his network that he was prepared to start opposing Trump on his immigration policies and on his tariffs that have been instituted lately, and I think oppose some of the, or at least withhold support for some GOP lawmakers, perhaps who are behind these policies. So you know, Trump, being Donald Trump, can't take any kind of criticism, so he had to lash out on Twitter as he often does. But I think that both his tweets and both Charles Koch's statements are not nearly as powerful or forceful as they appear to be.
So what do you mean by that? You mean there's not a real split here?
Well, I think there's a little bit of bad blood. I mean, you know, Charles Koch and his brother David and the Koch Industries conglomerate that they run are certainly first and foremost concerned with their bottom line, their profits. And so when there is a major policy development nationally that will, or statewide, that will affect their company's profits, they have this powerful network that they can launch to try to change things. But so the immigration policies, these harsh immigration policies preventing immigrants from coming here, both undocumented and legal immigration, you know, that's going to hurt Koch Industries because they're a huge American company. They, like many other companies, I imagine, depend on some immigrant labor. And so they oppose that. And they're also libertarians. So I think to some degree they do adhere to some of those principles. And then the tariffs are clearly bad for their business. They're a global business. They have operations in Europe, all around the world. So Koch Industries certainly doesn't want to see those tariffs continue. But I will argue, and I'm pretty certain about this, that the trade-off that they made, essentially, you know, getting the tax cuts they got in December, getting the bank deregulation bill they got a few months later, and now having the Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin start to float the idea of another massive tax cut, which would be $100 billion on a capital gains tax cut. So all these things are netting them a huge gain, despite several years of perhaps bad trade policy and definitely several years of very bad immigration policy. So I think that, you know, Charles Koch is known at this point for comparing himself to civil rights heroes. So at these summits, he always opens saying, just like Frederick Douglass, that's his latest hero that he compares himself to, just like Douglass, I will work with anyone to do the right thing. So right now he's saying, I'll work with Democrats to change these immigration laws, get rid of this strict enforcement, and to get rid of the tariffs. And look, I don't think anything they've ever done has not been about ultimately their profits. And I think this is just another example of them being ultimately concerned about their profits.
So tell me, do you think that they got the Koch network's co-chair, Brian Hooks, released a statement saying that the divisiveness of this White House is causing long-term damage? That's become a headline. Is that perhaps what got under Trump's skin?
Oh, that certainly could have. I mean, honestly, I think Trump basically sees any criticism of him the same. I mean, it's either praise or it's criticism. And so if it's criticism, he rarely misses the opportunity to go online, whether it's him or whether it's his comms director, you're never quite sure, but go online and excoriate those who criticize him, call them total jokes, call them losers, call them totally insignificant. Charles Koch is one of the most powerful people in America, perhaps the most powerful political donor in the country. To call them a joke is obviously wrong. They're very serious, and they're definitely not a joke. They're very powerful, and their operation rivals the size and sort of personnel and funding of the Republican Party itself. So they wield enormous power, especially in a party that increasingly is beholden to these large political donors.
Well, they didn't really support Trump very much, from what I recall, in the 2016 elections. But because their network has so much digital information on the electorate, on the Republican voting electorate, they were very, very helpful for the House, were they not? Didn't they really basically, I mean, let's face it, everything that the House has passed so far, which is not very much, has all benefited the Koch brothers, has it not?
Oh, absolutely. You know, the Obamacare repeal failed twice, I believe. The Koch network has spent lots of money via several groups, including Generation Opportunity, which is specifically a nonprofit that is supposed to galvanize millennials against the Affordable Care Act. So they that's business owners and libertarian, very, very, very wealthy billionaire business owners. They want to see that law completely killed, and it looks like it's well on the way to doing that. But, you know, the tax cuts in December were enormous. They raised the deficit by, I think, about at least $1 trillion. That's insane for people who are libertarian, to call themselves libertarian, to actually support this massive deficit increase and the following, you know, debt that comes from it. And then, of course, the banking deregulation bill in the spring was great for them. You know, Koch Industries actually has a private equity arm that is benefiting from both of those laws. And now this new capital gains tax will directly benefit Charles and David Koch themselves, the tax reduction, rather. But one point I want to get back to, which a lot of people miss, is that the Koch network didn't put out ads specifically saying vote for Donald Trump for president in 2016. However, they put out ad after ad, millions and millions of dollars into the U.S. Senate races. And what they did, because they never support Democrats, they would tie the Democratic candidate to Hillary Clinton in a very negative way, because castigating Clinton and tying the Democratic Senate candidate to her, and then sort of praising the Republican for being on the opposite side of things. So I will argue that the network did directly benefit Trump via those ads. And as you mentioned, the Greater Congress, I mean, they've been instrumental for several election cycles now in turning Congress red. And it's we're not sure if the House is going to flip this November. It might. But I think without the Koch network, I mean, it wouldn't be nearly as there wouldn't be nearly as large a Republican majority right now.
Well, of course, one of the ironies that came out of this conclave in Colorado Springs, their latest one that the Koch brothers held with their network, is that Senator Bernie Sanders sarcastically praised them on Monday night and thanked the libertarian-leaning Koch brothers, David and Charles, for supporting Bernie Sanders' proposal of Medicare for All. And I'm just quoting Bernie Sanders, "Let me thank the Koch brothers of all people for sponsoring a study that shows that Medicare for All would save the American people $2 trillion over a 10-year period." And that's the Mercatus study. And I believe the Koch brothers support the Libertarian Mercatus Center. So that's obviously a little amusing and ironic. And then, of course, one of the things that alarmed Republicans early in the year was when the Koch brothers funded some digital ads praising North Dakota Senator Heidi Heitkamp for her work on deregulating banks. So is Trump lashing out because he's worried and that maybe the Koch brothers are going to perhaps support some Democratic candidates or at least some Democratic ideas?
I'm very doubtful that the Koch network would actually ever endorse or run an ad in favor of a Democrat. I think what they were doing with Heitkamp and some of the other, perhaps some of the other moderate or centrist Dems, was just encouraging them to vote for, you know, bills that the Kochs like in the future. So they wanted to thank Heitkamp for her vote on the deregulation bill. I do believe coming out of this Colorado Springs summit, they said they're not ready to endorse Heitkamp's opponent. So that is significant. Generally, they're a rubber stamp on any Republican, conservative Republican running for office. One thing I'll say about the Mercatus study, and I'm glad you brought it up because it's interesting. A lot of the initial reports mentioned that it was you know, the study on Medicare for All by the Mercatus Center, not so much as even mentioning the word Koch and how, you know, Charles Koch is not just a funder. He is the primary funder. He was instrumental in setting the center up, and he's had various seats on the board and stuff. So this is basically an extension of the Koch network and Koch Industries. So they're notoriously, you know, far right free market capitalists. And a lot of the conservative outlets cherry picked one stat from that, which was the total cost, I believe, for over 10 years, and failed to mention that it actually is, that cost is less than, in terms of all total spending, it's less than, what the current status is. So, I could see how Bernie would make a joke out of that. But clearly they don't support big government health care. They would like it to be entirely privatized.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, what do we make of, I mean, Trump's clearly lashing out at them. I mean, it's true. He's infantile. He's reflexive. Anybody criticizes him, he goes ballistic. But I think, wasn't it David Koch, who was, along with Peter Thiel, was the only non-family member in the Trump Tower on the night of the elections, celebrating with Donald Trump?
Well, I do remember that Koch did go to a celebration. I didn't hear about how many non-family members that were there, but it was interesting that he showed up. And he's also a member of Mar-a-Lago, at least he was, a paying member of this expensive membership at Trump's exclusive club in Florida. So, I'm very skeptical when the Kochs say they're opposed to Trump, especially seeing what they've gotten from Trump. And as I said before, I think what they've gotten outweighs what they don't like right now. I do think that, it is interesting if this rift plays out a little longer, just to see how the Republican elected officials respond. You know, do they side with the most powerful political donor network on their side of the aisle, or do they side with the current president, who is deeply unpopular nationally but is extremely popular among Republicans? My cynical view is they'll probably stick with Trump just because, if you saw from the recent DeSantis, the Florida gubernatorial candidate, DeSantis campaign ad that came out yesterday, these Republican candidates are bending over backwards to proclaim their allegiance to Trump. I don't think that based on the polling, they're gonna separate too far from him. Even people retiring like Jeff Flake are tentative to really go in, all in against Trump. It's interesting, but Charles Koch, while he's 82 years old and he plans to exit the network eventually, his son Chase is in line to take over. I think he'll be very similar to his dad. So the Kochs aren't going anywhere. Their funding isn't going anywhere. And I will be interested to see if there are any members of Congress, for example, who kind of take Koch's side of things and start to try to push back on some of Trump's really heinous policies that he's implemented, which so far generally the Republicans either say something, so they're very concerned publicly, and then they don't do anything, or they just ignore a lot of these horrible policies.
Well, Alex Koch, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much. Yeah, always a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Koch, who's a freelance writer and investigative journalist focusing on money and politics. His work has appeared in The Nation, Vice, The International Business Times, and a new startup, Sludge. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Mars. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.